Osiris.
Across the Margin, the podcast is a show that brings you in-depth interviews with notable authors, artists, musicians, activists, filmmakers, and introspective eccentrics of all kinds, diving deeply into topics that demand deeper examination and illustrating the notion that there are captivating stories to be found everywhere. Across the Margin, the podcast is proudly in the loop.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a two-part episode. We start off with a great conversation with Sean Foley about the situation in the Middle East. Sean is a colleague of mine. He's professor of history at Middle Tennessee State University, a brilliant guy. And if you listen to this podcast for a while, you know he's our resident Middle East historian. And I was confused about what's going on in Saudi Arabia. There's been different claims of strikes. Was it Iran? Was it the Houthi rebels in Yemen? So in all that confusion, I thought, I need to talk to Sean Foley. And I thought, if I'm confused, I'll bet other people are too. So we're going to open this episode with a great conversation with Sean. And we love that guy. And if you've heard him before, you know he's outstanding as a scholar and as a colleague, I will say. Love Sean Foley. Then after that, Bob and I roll into a conversation about his research. We catch up on some things from the last episode on research that we did, kind of clarify some things. Bob talks about what he got right and wrong in that last episode. We add some information. It's a lot of fun. So thanks to everyone who enjoyed that last episode. You'll get a little more of that talk in the second half. You'll also get a really exciting announcement that we have, and I don't want to share it right here because I want Bob and I to share it together. So once you get through with Sean's episode and you're a little bit smarter about the Middle East, as I certainly was, then get ready for some exciting news. We thank you all for listening to the podcast and hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks. Sean Foley, welcome back to The Road to Now.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to see you in person, and always a pleasure the opportunity to speak to you and your very informed listeners who respond in multiple ways online and other things. Again, I've really been impressed by what you've been able to do with this show in recent years. It speaks well about your commitment to education, both at the university level, but also broadly. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to your listeners.
Well, thank you, Sean. We have the good fortune of having very smart people around us who can come on and explain things to people.
I'll do my best.
Oh, Sean, what I love about having you I loved a lot of things about having you on faculty. You're a great colleague. You're also a great scholar. And, you know, I know something a bit about the Middle East, but anytime my brain is spinning and I don't know, you know, what's going on exactly, I say, I'm going to go find Sean Foley. And here we are with the microphone, and now I can share the blessing of having Sean Foley as a colleague with our listeners. Sean, what is going on right now with Saudi Arabia? We've heard so many stories about these drone strikes. We heard it was the Houthi rebels. They took responsibility. Then other people saying it's Iran. I believe that we're sending troops right now into the Middle East, into Saudi Arabia, correct?
And also to other bases in the region. Remember, we have a constellation of bases in the region. We have facility. We are, of course, closely allied with the Saudis and been closely allied with the Saudis for many decades. In fact, they're having their Saudi National Day today in a video as part of that featured a picture of one of their important leaders, King Abdulaziz, meeting with FDR on a famous moment for them and for us. So this is a relationship that goes back decades. But we not only have relationships with the Saudis, we also have a very large military base in Qatar, which actually has had its own interesting relations with the Saudis in recent years, and also in the UAE. Dubai, for instance, is a major base. Also, Bahrain, another country. Again, we have a constellation of Air Force, naval, military, army, you name it. We're in that part of the world. We have a significant amount of firepower and a significant amount of commitments that we have made to these regional states to provide for security. And also should be noted that we have a whole series of economic connections between them. Mm-hmm. We import alone from the Saudis over $17 billion of oil. Which is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But also there are close cultural and other connections. As you know, both at this university at Middle Tennessee, that we've had many Saudi students over the years. Again, they've spoke very highly of you as a teacher.
Oh, that's fantastic.
As well, both Saudis and as well as Kurdish students as well. One of them spoke that she had to define what a good teacher was. It was you.
Oh, that's the nicest thing ever.
I do. I'm just telling the truth here when these things happen. So, again, a good reminder of that. It was in an interview. It was a nice opportunity to hear that. But back to the Saudis and to things with this as well. And again, happy Saudi National Day, I should say that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, say that as well. But a couple of things to mention about what's happened. They were attacked last weekend, and the attack hit two major oil facilities, Khurais and Abqaiq. Very important oil facilities. And Saudi Arabia is a major oil exporter to the world, either first or second to that of the United States. Immediately because of these attacks on these major oil facilities, there was a significant increase in the price of oil, about the same as what had happened in 1990 around the Gulf War. Not quite the same, but in those numbers as well, there's been about a 6 cents increase in U.S. gas prices, at least as of this morning over the last week. Not a huge spike, but enough of a spike. And it should be noted that it's not only important, what happens in Saudi Arabia is not only important to the United States, but also, as we were talking before the show, significant exports go to China, over $29 billion of exports, Japan, India, South Korea, major countries in Asia all have strong trading relationships where they export goods and services to Saudi, but also import significant amounts of petroleum. And it should be noted that Saudi Arabia and the states around it are also part of a large process that China is developing called the Belt and Road Initiative, which is supposed to link it to countries all the way as far away as Great Britain and Spain. And the states of the Middle East as energy exporters are key to that as well. So lots of players are here.
Wow. So whoever did this really threw a rock at a hornet's nest.
Absolutely. The Chinese, for instance, have not said publicly who they believe did this yet, although both the United States and Saudi Arabia have strongly indicated that they believe Iran was at play. Initial reports had that the drone strikes came from the south. As you said, the Houthis said that they did it. The Houthis, I should note, are a group within Yemen. They are a Shia group. As I'm sure your listeners know, the majority of Muslims in the world are Sunni, minority are Shia. They're about 45% of the population in Yemen and have been involved in a civil war over the last decade. They are closely allied with Iran,
right,
which is Shia. But it should be noted, to make things even more complicated, there are Shia populations within Saudi Arabia, different populations in the south that have longstanding ties to the Shias in Yemen, as well as Shia populations in the eastern province where the attack took place and where most of Saudi's oil facilities are. It's a very complicated scenario. And to make it even more complicated, these are major oil refineries, and Saudi Arabia has a major oil company called Aramco, state oil company founded by the Americans way back when Roosevelt was president.
Wow.
A long time. And that company is now planning an initial public offering, first in Riyadh and then probably in Asia, in Japan, although that has not been settled yet. So to make things, you're sort of a hornet's nest, not only for the international economy, but also for an important part of an initiative by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to privatize a portion, by no means not all, of Aramco, and as part of an important initiative that he has to reform the Saudi economy and actually to break their long-term dependence on oil exports. It was a significant attack.
Smart.
And it should be noted
to diversify, right?
Smart to attack. No, and again, that was, oh yeah. Well, in terms of a strategy as a way, and it should be noted also, to make it even more complicated, the United States and Iran, that have had a difficult relationship for a long period of time, has become even more complicated during the Trump administration, when the Trump administration pulled out of a nuclear agreement that the Iranians had. But it's become also clear in recent weeks that shortly before this occurred, that the Americans and the Iranians were moving towards some level of conversation. In fact, today marks the beginning of the UN General Assembly in the fall. And in fact, there were open discussions before this occurred that President Trump would actually be meeting with the president of Iran potentially at that. So there are all kinds of complicated...
So this isn't going to happen now?
Not likely, yes. But again, the president has kept the option open of dealing with the Iranians. How we respond is also a complicated issue. We certainly have military power, which we could certainly use. As I said, we have a constellation of assets, very strong, powerful assets. We could also potentially use cyber warfare, which we've used in the past. But again, all these come with complications. If you attack the Iranians with military power, they certainly have an idea it might be coming and could also hit targets, other oil facilities in the Gulf. Other issues include the Iranians' capability of hitting not only sort of oil facilities, but also desalination plants. Yeah, and again, as your listeners know, the Middle East is hot. There's not a lot of water. And if you don't have water, and you have a problem. And again, these are very complicated facilities, so this would be a problem. And also, the Iranians have very good cyber capabilities.
Right.
In fact, they've already taken down Aramco's computers in the past.
So this is where you're trying to piece together who did this. And you're saying, okay, the Houthi rebels in Yemen have claimed responsibility for it. But I've heard people saying they probably wouldn't on their own have the capabilities to send this many drones and hit such specific targets. That's where people say, well, then Iran must be behind it. Is this because there's a relationship between Iran and the Houthis? Perhaps they delivered these weapons to the Houthis?
That's certainly possible. There's also not even clear where the missiles came from. There have been discussions that the missiles might have come from the south. There have also been public discussions that the missiles might have come from Iraq or somewhere in Iran. And it should be noted, just as the American political establishment, as anyone looks at us, knows that we have different centers of power. Nancy Pelosi is a very different political figure than the president. There are different political figures and different political institutions within Iran itself. The Iranian Republican Guard, for instance, have their own military capabilities that might be similar to or different. The supreme leader has ultimate military authority, but there are multiple different facets. There are multiple different things. There have been attacks on shipping in the Gulf by the Iranians. There have been issues in Iraq. Israel, I should be noted, just had an election, a second election this year. That's another complicated story. Is also, there have been reports of it being involved in operations against Iran in Iraq. It is extremely complicated in where these missiles came from. And one other thing that's important for your audience to understand, the Russians have emphasized publicly that if the Saudis had their own missile system, that they might be better prepared. Perhaps, but drones are very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, this is what you were saying earlier when you first got here, was that like there's really no way to stop this from happening without causing all types of problems.
Right. I mean, drones, for instance, the U.S. Army deals with them by shooting missiles or lasers at them till they fall. Now, if you're in the battlefield and you're heavily fortified, that's okay. But if you're in a city or near a major oil facility, which are complicated, this is a significant problem. Now, and so it's difficult to even find. And by the way,
you shoot them down, and they've got a bomb on them that's going to go off wherever they fall.
Yeah.
Ah.
It's a very complicated problem, and it's a problem that, and particularly when you deal with, remember, Saudi Arabia is a vast state with vast resources, vast areas. There's a section of it called the empty quarter because nobody's there. So providing aircraft cover, providing radar cover is a significant expense. And a significant complication. And also should be noted, the sea lanes in the Gulf and other things, this is all complicated. Now, for its credit, and it's very interesting to see this, the Saudis have been very calm diplomatically. They've said through diplomatic channels that they see this as their equivalent of their September 11th. But they've said the Iranians have done it. But they've also not been especially belligerent in their response. They've been taking it carefully. And they've also done one other thing very importantly. They put enormous resources, all their resources, in getting those two facilities back up. And that's very important. And again, as you would say, smart, because A, it means that they can make clear to their customers, particularly their major customers in Asia, places like China, Japan, and India, South Korea, that those oil resources are coming. But second, so when the IPO happens.
So they've just demonstrated the absolute capability they have. If we're hit, let's move faster. Because I remember people saying that they expected oil prices to go up a lot more. And then they came back and said, it looks like this is not going to be nearly as long. They're not going to be offline as long, right?
Right.
And this is really an amazing feat that they're pulling off, huh?
Oh, sure. And again, reports this morning said next week. We'll see.
Next week.
But remember also, one of the things that makes this whole process so fascinating to watch, besides what I mentioned about Belt and Road and growing economies in Asia, is that A, the trade tensions between the United States and China have meant that the global economy is not nearly as vibrant as it was a couple of years ago. If you look at, say, rigs, which is one of the measures that are used for future demand for oil or companies buying rigs, those have gone down. So people don't expect the global economy. And it should be noted two things. First, despite this problem happening, large portions of the global oil economy, places like Venezuela and Iran, are off. But at the same time, the Permian Basin, which is a huge new area of oil or area of oil in both Texas and New Mexico, is pumping a lot of oil. In fact, so much so that we have briefly overtaken Saudi Arabia at certain points as one of the major exporters, or at least the major producer of oil. We don't export as much as they do, in part because the Saudis don't use nearly as much oil as we do. They're right. A much smaller country. But that's very much part of the equation. The Permian Basin is producing more oil than Kuwait.
Really?
It's a major.
When did this go online?
This has been gone online for the last 10 years. And the Permian Basin is reflecting something called fracking. And there are all kinds of other environmental and other issues with fracking. That's another show by itself.
Yeah.
But the ability for the United States to have a much greater degree of diplomatic and military maneuverability because of what's going on in Permian and other contexts. And it should also be noted, as I'm sure your listeners know, there's been a lot of discussion on environmental movement. And one of the things that's done has been significant investments in energy other than oil.
Right.
That also includes, fuel efficiency standards are much higher than they used to be. This is not the 70s anymore, or even the early 90s or the 2000s. And so there's significant investments in cleaner energy, but also in fuel economy. One of the amazing things when I teach this about the oil embargo in the 70s, yes, the United States lost a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
But in the long run, the Saudis understood that was not good for them because people made major investments
in cheaper cars that got better gas mileage, right?
That's correct.
Oh, the Ford Mustang too.
but also in other investments in cleaner energy, in more efficient homes and other things that reduced energy usage. So we're not in the same situation. We're sort of in an interesting, the framework that many of us, particularly over the age of 30, understand of this is from the Gulf War, in the early 90s, or even some of us who may be older enough, or certainly people tell us about what happened in the 70s, those moments, we're not in that moment, nowhere close. But that doesn't mean this is not an extraordinarily important moment, which has a hornet's nest of reverberations that go all the way from here, where we are in Tennessee, all the way to China. Across the world, almost everybody is touched. Remember, oil is a fungible commodity. It moves everywhere. And at the point, although we're moving towards new types of energy, we're still where the internal combustion engine, just as it was in 1900, is still, as you teach classes on American history and J.D. Rockefeller and all, that's still pretty important. And it's going to be important for a while. How we use that energy is a different question. And of course, the amount of cars now being produced in China and used in China is also something else. And again, these are all parts of this. I should note also another major power involved in this. You have expertise not only in American history, we teach great courses, but also in Russia.
Yes.
You spent some time there. The Russians are also involved in this because they are also themselves oil exporters.
Yes.
And also because of their own significant security interests, as we've talked about previously in Syria, but also in the Gulf. They're close allies with China.
Yeah.
And it should be noted that China has close relations, long-term relations with Iran. And in fact, the Belt and Road Initiative, this large project from President Xi, effectively linking, China with Africa, with Europe, with the Middle East, huge partnerships. Iran is right at the center of it.
Uh-huh.
It's a key, as one analyst told me, it's one of the important pieces to the puzzle because Iran provides a land route for oil. Remember, from Iraq or Iran to Pakistan, from Pakistan to China.
Right. So let's go back to this question of responsibility. If you're Iran, and from what you've just described to me, I would say if I had drones and I were Iran, and by sending those drones, I could infuriate a lot of countries and perhaps bring them together at a time when there's been disagreement. I could prompt a war here. What's in it for them?
Okay. I am not an Iranian decision maker. So, and I'm not in Tehran.
John Foley, tell me why you did this.
Yeah. But let me say a couple of things. There is little question for the last 3 years that President Trump would like to sign, would like to meet with the Iranian leader. He has said so on multiple occasions. In fact, during his negotiations with the North Koreans, he specifically said, we also want to talk to the Iranians.
He's trying to fill out that bingo card of all the dictators in the world, right?
Right, I guess. Iran's a complicated country with its own
political theocracy.
Theocracy, but also its own democratic political.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, again, another show.
So he wouldn't be meeting with the Ayatollah, right?
We meet with the president of Iran.
Okay, yeah.
But who's different than the supreme leader? Those are two different positions. But it should be noted that this is part of a long-term discussion of getting leverage. And again, that doesn't mean that everybody in the Iranian community is going to think on the same playing field. And remember, this happened shortly after John Bolton was fired or resigned, depending on who you talk to. And Bolton had very strong hawkish views, extraordinarily hawkish views towards Iran. And many people saw that decision as part of Trump signaling to the Iranians that we were willing to talk. And at a certain level, there are parallels to sort of very strong political negotiations and how the process of negotiation happened with North Korea as it did with Iran. And so at a certain level, Iran is making clear. And by the way, it presents a significant challenge. For instance, if we use military power, we could bomb Iran. Iran has, unlike, say, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or these other things, they have clear targets.
Yeah, they're a nation state.
They have clear, obvious targets. We know how to bomb things. We can blow things up real well.
Yeah.
We can do that. We could also, if we want, use cyber. President Trump previously did that when they shot down one of our drones earlier this year during the summer, that the president almost used weapon systems and then decided to use cyber. The problem with cyber is, A, it's not clear cyber is a real deterrent.
Right.
Because, A, the other side has cyber capabilities. They've been able, for the Iranians apparently have been able to stop, take Aramco's computers, but also things like American banks or a Las Vegas casino.
Wow.
But also, if the problem with cyber systems is that you really need to use them only once.
Right, because they'll know how you got in then.
Not only do they know how they got in, they'll develop counter systems. And that unlike nuclear weapons, this is a fascinating article in the New York Times about this morning. Unlike nuclear weapons, where it's fairly clear what you got, you don't want to tell people how great your systems are, because then they'll develop countermeasures.
Right.
And so one of the significant problems the American administration has, and the Saudis know this, is that we do not necessarily have a deterrent capability. When you asked about the Iranians, remember, the Iranians know that they're in an interesting strategic position. The Chinese didn't say who did it. They haven't said who did it. They condemned the action, but didn't say who did it. They have their own trade and other issues. The Iranians know that. The Iranians also know that if we use that military power, again, even the military operation that we were planning on using that Trump aborted, probably would have involved warning the Iranians first, this is back in the summer, that we were going to bomb their boats, giving them time to get out of those boats, and then sinking them.
Right. So even then, this is interesting, because what you're laying out is, it sounds like you're describing the Trump administration as being very cautious and very thoughtful about the implications. This is not the standard interpretation we get of most of Trump's decision making.
No, and again, it's fascinating to watch this. And in fact, Trump himself is commented, like, look, you thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
But at a certain level, he's making the same decision making that his predecessor did.
Really?
Well, remember, when we had the moment to attack Syria in 2013.
Right.
We didn't do it. We tried to find a different way. And that decision had all kinds of ramifications.
Well, yeah, because Obama said, if you cross over this line, then we'll do this. And then he didn't.
Right. And it should be noted, I was in Saudi at the time. I was doing research for my book I just came out this year. and called Changing Saudi Arabia. I guess
we're going to talk about it in a second. There's no way we're not going to plug your book.
Thank you. But I was in the country at that time. In fact, I was doing research in the South, close to, and it should be noted that the Houthis have been able to attack major airports. You cannot fly into major Saudi southern cities. So at a certain level, Trump has shown a degree of caution. And at the same time, this sort of basic issue is what happens when the military power, no matter how ferocious it is.
Yeah. What happens when you blow it up? We're still answering that question all over the world, aren't we?
As a friend of mine once said to me, the best nuclear weapon is one that stays in the silo because it becomes a threat. The minute the missile leaves, and a certain level, the Iranians know they have the cyber capability to hit us. And think of all the different ways that we're all interconnected. This is on a podcast.
Yeah.
And the Iranians have developed very good capabilities. We could certainly take down it, but at what cost?
Right.
As Agnes King told the New York Times, this is not like an attack on New York City. And the Saudis, for their part, understand that they're in a delicate situation. They said, we don't necessarily have the friends we used to. Now, American administration is sending troops. We will help them beef up their security. But at a certain level, only so much we can do. We have a gold-plated military. Mm. And that creates and it should be noted that the administration, when dealing with the Iranians, has tried to use sanctions and other forms of strategic power that don't necessarily have the same level of blowback. But again, if this continues, if you're from the Iranian perspective, you ask that question, what have you lost?
Yeah, so I know you got to go. You're very busy. Yeah. One last question on this topic. How much of what's going on now, if this is Iran, how much of this is related to Trump's decision to pull the United States out of the agreement that we were in?
Absolutely. There's no question. And it should be noted that the Trump administration's sanctions have had enormous bite.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No, this is remember, a couple things. The dollar, it may not be forever, but the dollar is still a major currency. Our ability and control of resources, of dank and other types of resources, of American-controlled either in Europe, American-controlled resources in Europe, or our major financial markets in Europe. It should be noted the Saudis would have preferred to have done their IPO in New York City because of the volume of wealth, but for a variety of reasons are probably not going to do that. But it should be noted that the sanctions have had significant bite. And that have made life harder for Iranians. The Iranians had hoped that the 2015 deal would pull things out, that they would be able, for instance, people developing web companies and other types of things would hope that they'd be able to sell to, say, Uber or to Facebook or more importantly, to Amazon. They haven't been able to do that. Other resources, other basic resources. The Iranians want to be able to trade with us. They would like to be able to have those resources, and it's had a significant impact on the Iranians. And absolutely, there's no question of the decision to pull out of that, and not only to pull out, but also then to effectively go bring back the types of regimes that put the Iranians in the first place. The Obama administration used sanctions and built a very wide coalition to make the Iranians pay. Remember, China still buys a little bit of its oil from Iran, but nowhere like it used to, because a Chinese oil buyer has to weigh. How much do I really need that oil from Iran versus the ability to sell that assets in dollars? And remember, most oil is still sold in
dollars. This is fascinating. So overall, would you say that Trump's handling of Iran since he came into office and the decision to pull out of that treaty, was that a smart decision? Or do you think that in the end it was a bad decision?
I understand why they made that decision, that the feeling was on the part that we did not have a sufficient deterrent capability, that despite the agreement, the Iranians were – it's hard for me to say. I hate to think an either or, yes, no.
Yeah.
But from – shall we say – let's look at from their perspective. They believed that the Iranians, despite the agreement, were not living up to it, and that we're still developing resources and threatening others, and that we could, if we use these resources, get a better deal. The answer at the end of the day is, what deal does Trump get? Does he get a deal that looks really similar? Does he get NAFTA 2.0? Do we get effectively like NAFTA 2.0?
Right.
Or do we get a better deal? And that, I think, is at a certain level, the jury's out on whether that makes sense or not. I think engaging with the Iranians is something that we're going to be blunt, we have to do.
Yes.
And It should be noted for all of the problems the Trump administration has been noted for someone who's for two peoples, the Trump administration and the Iranians, who seem to be at odds and threaten each other. They do a lot of talking.
Public face. And then there's the private.
Well, again, because it's a strategic interest, the Iranians at a certain level have developed strong enough capabilities to provide a deterrent. And how do you then provide a deterrent to them? That's become a question of American strategic and military power, and it's a puzzle we haven't answered yet.
Oh, wow. So many. I come in here with so many questions, and I get so many answers from you, and then I leave with more questions than I came with. I love the great conversation. Before we go, though, Dr. Sean Foley was recently promoted to full professor at MTSU.
Thank you. You were promoted as well, I should know.
Yes, senior instructor, yes. But you, sir, are the highest rank. You, sir, have made it. And you have a new book out. And you've been giving talks. You were at Georgetown recently giving a talk.
Georgetown. I've been in the Gulf. I've been in Europe also a couple of times. So I get around. Oh, yeah. The new book's called Changing Saudi Arabia. Thank you, by the way, for the opportunity to do so. Art, Culture, and Society in the Kingdom. It talks about how a cultural and artistic movement actually based in the South, in Apa, one of the areas which has been most hit by the civil war, by the blowback of the civil war in Yemen, how a group of people, including artists, people who are actually not initially trained as artists, one who was an emergency room physician, another one who was actually a soldier who went to school with two in the 9/11 bombers.
Wow.
Ended up becoming part of providing a voice to the Saudi masses and providing a new ways to talk about all kinds of issues, including women driving, women's rights, economic, political, social issues that have helped transform Saudi society and provide a framework not only for visual arts, but also stand-up comedy and film as well. Films actually that have been nominated to be considered for even for Academy Awards. Remarkable for a country developing movies even before 2018 movie theaters were allowed.
Wow. That is fascinating. You can go to look at your podcast player, or if you're on the webpage, there will be a link to pick up this book. And we're going to have you back on at some point and just talk about this book. Sean Foley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And again, I became full in part thanks to a group of people, including you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. One question that Bob and I get a lot is, how are we able to keep up with all these new books coming out and find out about all these great authors? Well, the answer to that is audiobooks. So you can imagine that Bob and I are really excited to have as our sponsor Libro.fm, the audiobook company that lets you purchase directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook companies, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen during your commute, while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers. There's also a curated playlist by The Road to Now where you can find authors who have been on our show. Recent guests include Barto Elmore's Citizen Coke, The Making of Coca-Cola Capitalism, The American Empire by Daniel Immerwahr, and Staying Alive, The 1970s and the Last Day of the Working Class by repeat Road to Now guest Jefferson Cowie. Since you listened to The Road to Now, we went out and worked out a deal with Libro.fm. You can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. Just go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter promo code RTN at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores, because when you subscribe and get books through Libro, a portion goes to a bookstore that you select and you want to support. So you're getting the books you love, you're supporting the bookstores that keep our community strong, and you're supporting The Road to Now, which we really appreciate. So thank you so much and enjoy this episode.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Bob, you're back in the bus. What's going on?
I am back in the bus. Detroit, which is where you and I met, Ben.
Oh, Bob, we did.
In fact, I was working out with Scott this morning, and he said, is this the place where we played where Against Me was in the other room next door to us? I said, no, that was the Magic Hat, Ben?
Yeah, Magic Stick, right?
The Magic Stick. That was the Magic Stick, because I remember that because that was the day I met Ben Sawyer.
2006. We've come a long way, Bob.
That's right. And if you pay attention to social media, maybe you're a member of the Avett Guild, maybe you're an Avett Brothers fan, you found out that The Road to Now Live is coming to a town near you if you live in Chicago or Carrboro, North Carolina, or Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's right, Bob. Being a historian and a comic has snuck me into music venues that I always wanted to play when I was a musician, but I wasn't good enough. And doing the Cat's Cradle in Chapel Hill is exciting for me. There's so much that I'm pumped about, Bob. Like, we've been working on this for, like, what, the last month and a half? And we've had to, like, not tell people, like, kind of keep it, make sure everything's right. And now we have these amazing live shows lined up. And we were going to start in 2020, but then, guess what? November 17th at the Beverly Arts Center in Chicago, we'll be coming up there. And let me tell you, our guest, I am so pumped about this. Our guest for that one, and we may have a few more on a panel, but what matters right now is that our guest is Erin Welsh from the podcast, This Podcast Will Kill You. She's an epidemiologist, a genius. She does the history of the diseases, and I love that podcast. Still knowing about measles from that podcast makes me terrified about people not getting vaccinated in a way that I never would have been. But she's funny. She's smart. Like, she's a baller. She just came back from a fellowship in Finland. And we are going to talk about how history informs her work as an epidemiologist. And that's just one part, Bob, because at these shows, you're not just going to get the conversations like we have with some amazing guests. And we're rolling out the carpet for these shows. And people have said yes. And I'm so amazed by it. But you're going to get some live music. You're going to get some stand-up comedy and history stuff from me. We're going to really combine everything that Bob and I have been doing for the last, I don't know, our lives into one great live show. And, oh, man, I'm so pumped.
We are so excited. And it is so appropriate to talk about Erin Welsh because on the last episode of The Road to Now, we discussed my research, which was about ChemStrand. It was a joint venture between the American Viscose Corporation and Monsanto. And you asked me, I said, I think Monsanto doesn't exist any longer. And you were like, are you sure about that? Yes, Ben, I can report to you today that Monsanto does not exist any longer. They were bought by Bayer, the German-owned maker of aspirin, acetaminophen, inventor of Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. They were bought by Bayer in June of 2018 for $63 billion. You could have had Monsanto, ladies and gentlemen, you could have had Monsanto for $63 billion. You know, my son wants to bring back the Seattle Supersonics. I say, son, if you want to do that, you got to grow up to be a millionaire. And you can bring back the Seattle Supersonics. But hey, if you grew up to be a billionaire, you could buy Monsanto.
Yeah, hold on a second, Bob. Because Monsanto exists still.
They don't exist. I've researched this thoroughly because they existed temporarily while they divested of BASF. But once that was completed, and I'll go to the Bayer's website. Bayer, this is August 16th of 2018, news release. Bayer, conditions for beginning Monsanto integration fulfilled. The integration of Monsanto into Bayer groups can begin following the completion on Thursday of the divestment by Bayer to BASF of certain crop science businesses with a total sales volume of around 2.2 billion euros. Bayer already became the sole owner of Monsanto Company on June 7th, 2018. One of the requirements of the United States Department of Justice that Bayer and Monsanto remain separate companies and continue to operate separately until completion of these divestments to BASF, and that has now taken place. The acquisition of Monsanto gives rise to a leading agriculture company with a high level of innovative strength. So this
This is genius because here's the thing. I didn't realize this. I know that they had gone into Bayer, but I thought they were operating as like a wholly owned operation within there. That is amazing. You buy the thing that now has a very negative name with most people, and you still do what they're doing, but you put it under the name. Oh, wow. Bob, do you remember whenever Nations Bank bought Wachovia? Do you remember
this? Walk all over you. I was a Wachovia banker. Walk all over you.
Dude, Yeah, but the great thing was, it's the same thing. It's like when a business makes money, but it's not got a very good reputation, changing names around works pretty well. Like, for example, if you're Nations Bank, who people really didn't like that much that I knew, and you buy Wachovia, and people love Wachovia because you get $5 out at the ATM. And for my people, that was pretty crucial because sometimes you didn't have 10. When they bought Nations Bank, and Nations Bank bought Wachovia, they changed the whole company's name to Wachovia. They bought the name as well and used it. And now you have an example of Bayer, which people are like, oh, Bayer, like they're friendly. They buy Monsanto and they're like, it's not really called that anymore, guys. You're like, is it still doing what it's doing?
It's all the evil and darkness under a new name.
A devil by any other name.
That's right. So that was one. I listened back to the episode, you know, that you and I recorded. And that was one thing, you know, it kind of gave me things I needed to look up. And I also said, full disclosure, I said that Monsanto, we knew about Monsanto because they made caffeine for Coca-Cola. At some point, they did dabble in caffeine, but Monsanto originally made saccharin. It was saccharin, and you can learn this yourself if you read Citizen Coke by Bartow Elmore, but or if you listen to it on Libro.fm. Mm-hmm. But so Monsanto came into business making saccharin for Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola was their biggest, maybe even at some point, their only client. And then I mentioned the American Viscose Corporation, who was in a joint venture with Monsanto. And they started Chemstrand. You said, well, what's up with them? I don't know. What do you know about the American Viscose Corporation? So then, this is what I've learned about the American Viscose Corporation. This company is a subsidiary of Cordald's. The Cordald family began setting up silk mills in the 18th century in Braintree, England. In the mid-19th century, the Cordald Manufacturing discovered rayon. In 1910, they established mills in the United States under the subsidiary American Viscose Corporation. World War II breaks out. 1941, Britain is in their darkest hour.
Oh, yeah.
The government of Britain is broke. They come to America. They need help. Roosevelt comes up with a plan. It's called Lend-Lease.
Yeah.
In the American Congress, we had a lot of isolationists.
Neutrality Act.
And they said, okay, well, we'll pass Lend-Lease, but on one condition. We want something from the British government. We want all of their American businesses. All the British-owned American businesses we want turned over to the federal government. And the Lend-Lease bill passed through the Senate on March 8th, 1941, and received the signature of Roosevelt on March 11th. Within a few hours, and I'm reading from the Ottawa Journal, Ottawa, Canada, May 27th, 1950. Within a few hours, a further grave issue arose. The $7 billion appropriation bill would come before the Appropriation Committee almost at once. And unless that too were passed, the Lend-Lease bill would be comparatively useless. The isolation opposition were not satisfied by the announcement already made. To them, it appeared as nothing more than a pious hope. They insisted that some tangible proof should be given of British good faith. They insisted that at least one of these businesses should actually be sold to America by the British government before the $7 billion appropriations bill should become law. And for the purpose, they selected the American Viscose Company.
Wow.
The British government were officially informed that it was absolutely essential that actual sale of the Viscose Company to America should be completed immediately and indeed before March 15th. So the British government goes to Samuel Cordald, the owner of the American Viscose Company, and says, you need to hand over your business to us. Now, you can't even think about it. Cordall was under no, I mean, they had the Emergency Powers Act in England, but it wouldn't sufficiently cover this. He didn't have to do this, but he did it. And this article's from May of 1950 because that's when the government finally settled with him and paid him for American Viscose. 1950. But so essentially, Britain gave American viscose to a conglomeration of American bankers. Charles Morgan was among that.
Did they hold it, or did they immediately sell it off? I mean, what's the...
The final arbitration between the United States, I guess between the bankers, between Britain and Courtauld, settled in 1950. So they gave it to them. And throughout the war, when you read up about it, American Viscose Corporation was working, they were making rayon for the war effort. They bought Sylvania, not to be confused with the lighting company, but they bought Sylvania. American Viscose purchased Sylvania in like 1947. So this company was moving independently. It was separated from Courtauld immediately.
Yeah. It was a wholly owned American subsidiary, right?
Yes.
That's one way to do it. Hey, Bob, you know why? And this is interesting. There are different ways that foreign businesses enter foreign markets. And by far the most profitable yet risky is the wholly owned subsidiary, because what that means is if you do a partnership, you have local people on the ground to advocate for you. If you do licensing, that means that you're just making not as much money, but someone's paying you to make your product. You really only do a wholly owned subsidiary like that when you believe that your goods and your company will not be confiscated. Whoops. And the reason I was talking to Mark Doyle, which I referenced earlier, was because he texted me to say he really liked this episode, and that made me very happy. And he did point out to me, he said, because remember we talked about oil prices, and I said the oil prices began to decline in the early 1980s. And he said back in Oklahoma, he remembers that basically family members talking about how the oil prices killed industry in Oklahoma in the early 80s. So I looked into it just to check it. And it's kind of like I was right, but I wasn't totally right in the sense that, like, yes, oil prices peak for that era in March of 1980, and they go down a lot, but they don't have that slump that I talked about that really kills the Soviet economy until March of 1986. However, basically by 1983, they had dropped down to about 33%. The price had fallen. So it's about to $70.05 a barrel. So it was going down, but the big slump didn't come till the mid 1980s. So oil prices are still relatively high. Just wanted to clarify that.
Ben, we are learning more and more every day thanks to this podcast.
Yeah. And speaking of companies, last week I actually did a mini-sode for our patrons on OxyContin and Purdue Pharma. And Bob, like, this was something that I thought was important. I just wanted to, like, add some stuff about it here. You can get the full episode on Patreon. But for those of you guys who are wondering why Purdue Pharmaceutical is being brought to its knees and ripped apart, and, you know, people are saying that the billions of dollars the family wants to pay in and all of this aren't enough, let me just give you some facts here, all right, about OxyContin. And there's more in the episode, but I just want to tell you guys about it because it's important. The reason OxyContin is such a big deal, and Purdue is responsible for this, is because Purdue Pharmaceutical, they slipped past the FDA misinformation. They cited in their submission to the FDA that it was not prone to abuse because it was continuous release. And the only thing they cited for that was a one paragraph letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980, which didn't even really reference what they were selling. The FDA tested it. The man at the FDA who told them not to aggressively market this, they told him, they said, you know, we can tell that you can actually get the substance out of this and abuse it. So the FDA report said, we suggest you do not competitively market this. Purdue Pharmaceutical definitely aggressively marketed it. By, you know, a couple of years into this, you're able to make $100,000 a quarter off of perks if you sell that stuff. And side note, the individual who oversaw the FDA's approval of that drug 2 years later was working as a consultant for Purdue Pharmaceutical. They constantly were trying to cover this information up. They really, in many ways, there's a parallel with the cigarette companies in the sense that they knew what the costs were far earlier than anyone acknowledged. They tried to cover up what they could, and they let people get addicted and kind of sat on a public health disaster without actually doing much about it. So I just thought, you know, since we're talking about research and everything, I wanted to bring this up. And just as a side note, most of the information here and on the more expanded version of this story that I did for Patreon came from Beth Macy's book that came out last year, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. So for those of you who are paying attention to this and you're not quite sure why this company is being hit so hard, this is why. I just thought you should know that. And yeah, so I wanted to add to that.
Crazy. And So anyway, I loved the episode that you and I recorded last week, and I listened to it. And by the time it aired on Monday, I was like, I knew more. You know, my research is continues every day. I know more and more. So I really wanted to correct a few of these major points that I got wrong. And I want to thank everyone for listening. And these past two episodes are pretty much self-indulgence for Ben and I.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode was edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer, and today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. If you have not gone and rated us on iTunes, please do so. We need you to do that so we can spread the word about this podcast. Everyone who has, we say thank you. Speaking of thanks, we'd like to say a special thanks to everyone on Patreon who helps make this podcast possible, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, Susan Sharp, Joseph Mann, Matt Williams, and Mariah Wolford. Mariah, thank you for tweeting at me and letting me know I was saying your name wrong. I'm so sorry. I appreciate it. And thank you for the kind words and the support. If you'd like to join our community of patrons and get lots of extra content, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow and pick a tier. For as little as $5 a month, you get access to episodes 1 through 75, some extras, bonus content, and it only gets better from there. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thanks for listening, and take care.